This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Our traveling fanboys.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the L-shaped studio in Vancouver, British Columbia, inside Ho-Ho Loon Plaza, for another edition of the Hard Traveling Fanboys. I am Greg Phillips. With me in the studio, as always, is the man of the hour, the tower of power, too sweet to be sour. He eats T-bone steaks, he lifts barbell plates, and he's sweeter than a German chocolate cake, Nick Duke.
I don't lift barbell plates, as you know. That's something that I would never do because it requires physical effort, and I don't believe in it, quite frankly. So while I appreciate the other series of compliments, and most of them are indeed accurate, that one, I'm afraid, is not.
Well, it's always something to aspire to, right?
No, not really.
Fair enough. Fair enough. We, of course, are the Hard Traveling Fanboys, and we are here continuing Shazam Month. Or, if you prefer, Shazam Month. Just 1 week ago, we gave you our exclusive review of the number one movie in America, which is still Shazam.
Hey, Warner and I think for once that was actually an exclusive review here on the Pop Feed. We didn't have to, you know, we didn't have multiple reviews floating around out there.
Well, I've heard that it's quite enjoyable if you can have multiple, Nick.
Oh, yeah. It always is good to have more than one at one time. If you can swing it, of course. Most people can't.
Most people can't. It's very difficult, from what I've heard, anyway. But nonetheless, we are continuing Shazam Month, and we are here to bring you a second edition of the Longbook Hunters this month. And while I've heard it through the grapevine that perhaps things were said on recent podcast episodes here involving a Slayton Jeff Johns creative run on the character of Shazam, or Captain Marvel if you prefer, we are ignoring that completely. Those are just rumors, folks. Any vocal similarities between myself and whoever uttered that story's name last week or the week before are purely coincidental, because the story that we're here to review today on the Longbook Hunters goes back a little bit further than that. It's a story from the 90s, and it's from a really under-the-radar legendary creator, Jerry Ordway, writer.
Can one be both under-the-radar and legendary?
Yes, I think so.
All right.
I think so, because I think there are certain legendary figures that are worthy of being called legends who aren't necessarily regarded in that light or talked about enough. Mm-hmm. And I think Jerry Ordway falls into that category. You know, another example of that might be a figure like a Jeff Blauzer.
Mike Mordecai?
Mike Mordecai. You know, Atlanta Braves legends that don't get talked about in the same reverence as, say, a Hank Aaron. You know,
or Raphael Furcal.
Raphael Furcal was a very good player.
Fred McGriff, the crime dog.
The crime dog. Now, that's another great under-the-radar legend. He should be in the Hall of Fame, in my opinion. So,
Andres, you know, One-Nut Galarraga?
Hey, that man was – he was a mountain of a man.
With one nut.
Hey, if you can do all that with one nut, then imagine what he could have done with two.
Who knows?
Nonetheless, we are here to review The Power of Shazam, a graphic novel that actually came out in, I believe, it was 1994. Mm-hmm. And yes, it was indeed from a writer artist. Good God. Jerry Ordway, with a little bit of an assist on inks, I believe, from Dick Giordano. But, yeah, this is very much Jerry Ordway's pride and joy, you know, his baby, if you will. And so we're here to take a look at that book. It's one that I actually bought on a whim about maybe 4 or 5 years ago on sale at a comic book shop, I think actually in Columbus that we were at. And so I just bought it on a whim and gave it a read. And I remember enjoying it at the time, but I haven't read it in several years. And I'd actually forgotten virtually the entire story here. So I had a chance to read it again. And Nick, I know this was actually your first time reading this story, correct?
Yes, as with Shazam and the Monster Society of Evil before it, this was my first exposure to the story. You know, original plans were for us to, you know, do a book that I had read before that you hadn't, but of course those plans went the way of all things for reasons that won't be discussed here on today's podcast, I'm sure.
Well, I will tell you the reasons for that are that I ran out of time to read a longer edition, and this was roughly half the length of the Jeff Johns and Gary Frank Shazam story. So at just about 95 pages, I figured I could get that read over the course of the weekend, and I did, no problem. Had it finished last night. So here we are. I was on a condensed schedule as well because I'm recording another podcast here at PTB and Pop, which I'm sure we'll hear all about after the break.
I
thought, hey, this is and as Todd Weber, the manager, so eloquently pointed out to us, this does illustrate a different era of Shazam than what people might get if they go to the movie, which is based heavily on the Jeff Johns era. So yet again, we're taking a look at another take on this classic character. And one of the things, Nick, that differentiates it from the Shazam and the Monster Society of Evil is that was going with the original Golden Age approach that Billy and Captain Marvel are two separate entities. This is going with the very modern approach of, and I'm not sure, folks, for any of you Captain Marvel experts out there that might have this information, I don't know if this was the beginning of the Billy and Captain Marvel are the same person. They, in other words, Captain Marvel shares Billy's mind when he is in Captain Marvel form, or if that goes back to the Roy Thomas reboot in the 80s or even further back than that. But nonetheless, it is that sort of modern approach that Nick and I encountered through cartoons that we see very much here. And it's an origin story for Captain Marvel. And one of the striking things about it as well is whereas the Monster Society of Evil was very much modern and clearly set in 2009 or whenever it was written, this book is kind of, Nick, I don't know if you would agree with me, I felt this was a little bit like Batman the Animated Series, and maybe that inspired this book a little bit from a visual and aesthetic standpoint, in that it feels like a period piece, does it not?
In a manner of speaking, I think it's trying to do that Batman the Animated Series thing of having its cake and eating it too, in trying to be a modern set story, but using visual cues to give you a sense of timeliness. They never really specifically state when this story is taking place. And really, you know, you could read it as taking place in virtually any era. I don't see any reason why it couldn't take place in modern times or in the 1940s, depending on how you wanted to approach the story, which I think is kind of an interesting move for a superhero comic.
No question about it. And it's an approach, by the way, Nick, that I've always thought would be a good one for Marvel to take with the Fantastic Four, but perhaps we can touch on that near the end of the podcast. So, like I said, this is an origin story, and it does kind of have this sort of retro feel to it, but one that doesn't specifically date it, as you mentioned. So, right off the bat, we are taken to an excavation, an archaeological excavation in Egypt. And we sort of get to meet Billy Batson's parents, which is something we didn't get to do in Monster Society of Evil. So we get to meet Cece and Mary Batson, and or not Mary. Was her name Mary? I can't remember. Certainly Cece Batson. And hang on, I'm working on this. Working on it. Yeah. CC Batson, and unfortunately I don't remember his mother's name, but nonetheless, we meet CC, and they are archaeologists working alongside their colleague Theo Adam, who of course will play a bigger role in this story moving forward. And it sort of it takes us through this excavation, and during this archaeological mission is sort of when the powers of Shazam, the titular or brestular power of Shazam, is unleashed upon the world, basically. So Theo Adam is a descendant, it seems, of Black Adam, who, as people who know this mythology understand, was the original champion of the wizard Shazam, who used his powers for revenge and thus had them taken away. And at the same time, the murderous actions that we see in this opening in the opening chapter lead to the wizard Shazam's meeting with Billy Batson. Billy in this story, Nick, is literally living on the streets. Very similar, I thought, the Billies here were very similar between here and Monster Society. Perhaps this one's a little bit more, a little bit older, I yes. think, and a little more streetwise.
Yeah, a little harder. It has a little harder edge to him than the, I mean, Shazam and the Monster Society of Evil is very intentionally aiming at a younger audience. And so as such, it's Billy is depicted as being more in the range of like, I would place him 8 or 9, whereas this Billy is probably a 13 or 14 year old kid, somewhere in that range.
Yes, that I agree with that completely. And so this Billy is, you know, he's been living on the streets clearly for a while. We know that he's been kicked out by his uncle Ebenezer, which is a good name, Nick, I find.
Mm-hmm.
And
they call him
has
Eben.
Been sort of
yeah, they call him Eben, Eben for short, or Eben. I'm not really sure which one.
I'm not sure either. I assume Eben just because of Ebenezer, but you know, they he's selling newspapers, which I would not recommend anyone to do for a living now, because I don't think you'll be able to buy many meals off of that.
How great was it when Dr. Burns, Dr. Shavana, or Mr. Burns, Dr. Shavana stole the newspaper from him?
That was pretty funny. I thought you'd get a kick out of that.
Yep, that was great.
Poor Billy gets robbed in his first, you know, he talks about how he's only sold 5 newspapers all day long, and here's this old man that comes up and essentially steals his newspaper. All right, step on it.
It was a total Mr. Burns move.
Totally. And which leads to him being called a skin-headed old man. It's a little harsh. But which we'll talk about Savannah a little bit later on. But Billy Batson he's a good kid. He's good at heart, as we see in all these stories, but he's also got an edge to him. And we see that, Nick, in a pretty interesting first meeting with Shazam, where Billy is granted the powers of Captain Marvel. And when he becomes Captain Marvel, his first reaction is not, wow, I've got these cool powers. His first reaction is, what have you done to me? I'm old now. and I rather enjoyed that scene of him going after the wizard, and he nearly crushes him under a stone pillar, in fact.
It's so, what I imagine it's like for Jeremy Reynolds to wake up every day and look in the mirror.
That can't be me.
104 years old? That's not fair.
And yet, arguably the most successful flirter in our entire friends group.
I don't think there's any doubt about that. I don't think there's any contest in that regard, you know. Granted, some of us have been able to successfully settle down, so there's something to be said for that.
You only have to be successful once.
That's right. once is enough. And in some cases, it's one time too many. But that's neither here nor there.
Wait just a minute. Good thing our podcast doesn't reach certain audiences. nonetheless, what did you make of the way that this Jerry Ordway interpretation of the meeting between – we talked about that harder edge that this mm-hmm. Billy has, that it's aimed at an older audience as we have more of a teenaged Billy. But what did you make of the differences between this and what we've seen both in the movie and also in Monster Society?
I liked it. It was different. Like you said, there wasn't this sense of wonder and amazement right away. It was more of a sense of distrust from Billy and led to, like you said, a more aggressive initial encounter between the two. But it's one that kind of makes sense. This is a version of Billy who's been out on the streets for some time, whose parents left him behind and never really came back, and he doesn't fully understand what happened to them and doesn't really agree with their decision to leave him behind in the first place. So it makes sense he would come at it from a little bit more skeptical and borderline paranoid worldview. So different, but I enjoyed it for this particular take on the character.
And I thought that the another interesting aspect of this telling of it was that the wizard here gives even less information to Billy than we've seen in other versions. Like, this was, to me, the most, all right, here are some powers, do your thing,
yep,
that we've seen. And there's no real – Billy doesn't get explained what's going on. He doesn't get a patient, you know, hey, this is what you're going to have, you know, all this stuff. He's just given this very quick Cliff's Notes version and then sent on his way. And so I enjoyed that aspect. And so the book is primarily about Billy getting these powers – learning how to deal with these powers and, you know, basically just learning how to be himself while also being a superhero, as he finds himself becoming later. And initially his mission is to get the powers back to the wizard, but he understands he has a mission to accomplish first. But really the other primary driving plot is the Theo Adams story. He is working for Mr. Savannah on this one, not a doctor yet. And Mr. Savannah owns this big industry.
He's not been to evil medical school quite yet.
Not yet. You get the feeling that he's on his way there. But
yes.
He runs this giant industry, this mysterious corporation, which, as all corporations are in the DC universe, is named after himself.
Yes.
So and they work out of Fawcett City, by the way, which I really like. I have – that was one thing I wanted to comment on here is – I love the concept of Fawcett City because I've always thought one of the things that separated DC from Marvel for me was the fictional cities.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Marvel takes place in more or less what's supposed to be the real world of New York and, well, primarily New York, but other cities as well. Whereas DC has Metropolis and Gotham and Central City and Keystone City and Coast City. And I actually like when they lean into that, lean into fictional cities that you get to build from the ground up versus it putting it in an existing city. So I appreciated how Ordway builds Fawcett City and makes it this sort of towering monolith that, like you said, is reminiscent of the animated series in that it seems like it could be in the 40s, the 50s, the 80s, the present day, whatever. So it's a really good job that Ordway does of creating this city, I thought.
Yeah, I liked it as well. It is timeless is the best way to put it. You know, you've got some of the, like, radio reporter trappings of it. It kind of – the radio is a mm-hmm. bigger deal than most modern forms of media. But, you know, we still listen to the radio today, so you could possibly lean into that a little bit. And, again, as a very – with a very basic understanding of Captain Marvel, my understanding is that WHIZ has been something of a fixture in his past for some
yes.
time, so it kind of makes sense they would work that in.
Absolutely. And so so Theo Adam is one of the archaeologists that works for Savannah, and he has sent them to uncover these artifacts in this ancient Egyptian tomb. Well, Theo Adam, of course, is blinded by greed. Actually, it was greed, right? So he's blinded by greed, one of the seven deadly enemies of man, and steals this this necklace, this pendant, which, as we later find out, give him the power, or the pendant gives him the power of Black Adam. And I gotta say, Nick, as somebody who I'm only familiar really with the modern interpretation of Black Adam, the mm-hmm. Geoff Johns reinvention of Black Adam, where he's an anti-hero, sort of like the Marvel, sort of like the DC version of Doctor Doom or Namor.
Yes.
And I had never really experienced this sort of classical take on Black Adam, where he's more of a straight up villain. And so, except I think in an animated movie, Superman, Shazam, The Return of Black Adam.
Which I'm pretty sure that was a short anyway.
Yeah, it was a short, it was like 20 minutes. So, yeah, the in other words, almost an entire DC full-length animated movie. Oh, anyway, but the the usage of Theo Adam in here was interesting to me because it's more of a – I mean he's just a bastard. He's worse than Savannah in this interpretation. Mm-hmm. Savannah clearly doesn't want him to kill people, but yet he does anyway. And I thought it was interesting in that it establishes that he's this greedy person who has even more of a personal tie to Billy Batson than what we've seen, and that he is responsible for the deaths of Billy's parents and the disappearance of his sister. So it gives this greater emotional weight to their battle because on the one hand, you've got the wisdom of Solomon, which is advising Billy to take this cautiously, and then you've got his natural rage and anger that he has towards Black Adam. So what did you make of Black Adam here? Obviously, it's the building blocks that would later lead into the version that we're probably more familiar with. But what did you make of this interpretation of a character that I know that we both enjoy in the modern era?
Yeah, well, very different because, as you mentioned, my understanding and enjoyment of the character is kind of framed around that conceit of him being a nation ruler, of being mm-hmm. from Kandak and kind of having, his people and his country's needs first and foremost in his mind at all times. This one is kind of more driven by his ego and by his own personal desire for power. So it's very, very different in that regard because there's no real way to contextualize his actions as being noble in any way, even if he takes, ignoble actions to meet his ends, as he often does in modern times. So different, but again, this is going for an interpretation of Shazam. This is a reintroduction. This is trying to reintroduce Shazam to audiences in 1994, and thus I think you didn't really have, especially in only the course of 94 pages, there wasn't really a lot of real estate to fully develop the more anti-heroic version of the character that we know and love. So for this version, I think it works.
Yeah. And this felt more like a Black Adam who is influenced by its human host, in this mm-hmm. case, Theo Adam, who's just a complete bastard. I enjoyed it as well. It was totally different from what I've expected, but he was a very effective and slimy villain for sure, who is drawn to kind of look a little bit like Humphrey Bogart, I thought. A little Humphrey Bogart, a little Lee Marvin maybe in there. Very interesting there. Now, Thaddeus Savannah in here, I actually ended up – this is going to sound weird because he's not a good guy. He okays a lot of bad things throughout the course of this. I ended up kind of feeling bad for the guy.
Why?
And here's why. Because, one calamity striking him, he deserves that. Two calamities striking him, probably deserves that too. But just – it seems like the guy just has the worst luck in the world. So his expedition that he sends to get this artifact ends up with one of his employees murdering two of his other employees and kidnapping their child, which he was unaware of. But then it turns out that he also tried to kill an Egyptian ambassador of some sort.
Wait a minute. Was he unaware of it? Because he'd been housing – Adam the entire time.
Oh, that's true. But he says that no, remember he has a reaction of surprise at one point during the book because he says you killed a child or something like that. Maybe I'm remembering his reaction to Adam at one point pushes Billy Batson off of a roof and then tells Savannah about it. He's like, "You killed a child by throwing him off a roof?" Mm-hmm. And He has that happen. He doesn't get his artifact that he was after, the entirety of it anyway. He's missing a chunk of it. And, that's bad enough. His little carnival show that he's trying to put together, his theme park for Fawcett City, is laughed at in the press and ridiculed. He looks, as you put it, like Mr. Burns, or Ross Perot, sort of. So – he's got that going against him. On Captain Marvel's first day on the job, he manages to accidentally destroy Savannah's bomb that was going to, thwart his plans for that. Then he ends up accidentally destroying his blimp and destroying his theme park. So poor Savannah. And then Savannah's house burns to the ground. And he ends up penniless and broke. So I feel a little bit bad for him.
No, he's a douchebag. He stole a newspaper, Greg. Never forget.
He did steal a newspaper. And, you know, every time you steal a newspaper or get one for free, that's money out of the pocket of hardworking reporters like me.
That's absolutely
or
right.
Or like I used to be. So always pay that $1.50 or whatever it is. But nonetheless, the Thaddeus Savannah character is, again, I feel like we have now experienced this month, Nick, three different versions of Savannah. And I get the feeling we may experience a fourth version next week. and thus far, they've all been radically different from one another. Or at least, maybe not radically.
I was about to say,
radically might be a bad word.
There are some similarities,
like,
for sure.
They've been different from one another,
right,
in some key ways.
Yeah.
So which of the three has stood out to you?
You know, like you said, they're all a little bit different. The Mark Strong one was good because it was a more physically imposing take. But I think the sniveling, conniving version from Shazam and the Monster Society of Evil, just because of the way he's drawn to look like a little penis man walking around, is probably my favorite one.
That's fair. A little penis man. Anyway,
well, does he not resemble a penis?
He somewhat resembles a penis.
Thank you.
But
on top, wrinkled. It's a penis.
Oh, smooth,
but not too smooth.
Not too smooth. No, crazy stuff here, folks. In our discussion of this classic children's character,
well, it's fitting in with the mud flaps from last week.
That's exactly right. So, Billy, what we end up with here is kind of an open ending where the basic story of Theo Adam, Black Adam, gets resolved by the end of this issue, and everything seems well, except that the wizard reminds Billy that his sister is still out there somewhere, and with his powers, he can find her. And so Billy agrees to keep the powers of Captain Marvel moving forward. So I don't think that's too much of a spoiler. Nobody really thought he would give up his powers. But it also it kept the door open for an ongoing, which ends up happening out of this, Nick. From March 1995 through March of 99, we had 48 issues and an annual of The Power of Shazam ongoing, which expanded the mythology established here in this graphic novel. But nonetheless, I thought this the story here was very effective if you view it as a one-and-done, but also leaves the door open to introduce some of the more fantastical elements of the Captain Marvel mythos. And here we don't get Talkie-Tawny, we don't get Mary Marvel, we don't get
Mr. Mind. Yeah.
We don't get some of the more outlandish aspects. It's very much, if I'm reading this correctly, and I wasn't reading at the time this particular area of the DC Universe, but I would assume that this was trying to gradually reintroduce this concept and this character to an audience that at that time was looking more for anti-heroes and things of that nature, things that were more, quote, dark and realistic.
Yeah, so it's very interesting that this was able to successfully take off and lead to an ongoing in this era, as you said. And unfortunately, no Mr. Mind and no opportunity for Billy to get a deluxe tickle.
I was in mid-water swig with the deluxe tickle. If only we could give visual aids on our podcast, Nick, because I feel like that's one that really needs it, because where do you think he was going to tickle him, Nick?
Well, I think that
– is it going to be in that firm, tight buttocks?
I think he was heading for the sphincter region.
He was heading south of the border, baby.
Well, doesn't Mr. Mind have to get inside an orifice to control something? Isn't that the gimmick?
I believe that's the case. I believe that's what we've been led to believe.
The deluxe tickle was coming.
You know, another good thing about Black Adam is that he's got a hairline that all of us can relate to. You know, he's losing that battle. You know, he's fighting that LeBron James battle, and he's losing it.
Mm-hmm.
But nonetheless, that being said, quite frankly, we haven't talked about the art, and I really want to talk about that because I thought the art was the biggest standout of this story. We talked about that retro feel, and I think that follows through in the way that it's colored, the way that it's inked, and especially the way that it's penciled. Everybody look, you know, you've got the granite-chinned classic Captain Marvel, but you've got sort of the slimy, Dr. Savannah. You've got the evil and warped and twisted, like I said, Humphrey Bogart or Lee Marvin version of Black Adam. And I really, really enjoyed the art here. It's this nice mix of realism with that doesn't feel out of place in the DC universe, and it carves out this very distinctive identity that reminds me of what other artists were doing in DC at that time, like the Tony Harris on Starman as he was building Opal City into this entity of itself. Or I think of the work that people like Dan Jurgens were doing on Metropolis in the Superman books, or even what you see in Themyscira with what George Perez did in Themyscira a few years earlier. So yeah, I really enjoyed how Ordway, and again, I maintain he's a very underrated and underappreciated master of the medium. He ends up creating this visual identity for this book that feels and looks different from anything else that he was drawing. This, in no way does this look and feel like any of his Superman books that I read when I was a kid.
Yeah, I mean, because I believe these are all painted interiors, if I'm not mistaken, which I doubt he would have done on monthly comics. So that right there, I mean, it lends to an added sense of detail, and it kind of instantly evokes Alex Ross a little bit, because Alex Ross is probably the most notable example in the modern era anyway of an artist who predominantly uses painted interiors as opposed to drawn ones. Yeah, like you said, this kind of has, again, it helps to give the book a timeless feel, because when you look at it, you know, when you think of books that come out in the 90s, you kind of think of big muscles and pouches and, you know, things of that sort. When you think of the 2000s, you tend to think of that more, you know, dynamic action with a lot of detail, kind of the Jim Lee taken to that next level, a generation of artists influenced by Jim Lee. And with this, it kind of feels like it could have come out in really any era. If anything, the art kind of reminds me of something from the 50s or the 60s, but in a good way, like kind of a throwback with a level of detail and precision we don't typically see from other books in the 90s.
I think I placed it. It looks like what you would see on the covers of those like romance and horror comics of the 50s.
Yeah, the action anthologies and stuff. Yes.
Right. And you don't see the, like you said, all of the hallmarks of 90s comics. The pouches, the gigantic, you know, bodybuilder muscles, the enormous breastular regions, quite frankly, on the women. It's a very Evil. I think they're both really good reads, and I think one thing that we're learning this month, at least I am, is there's a lot more to this character than I may have thought many years ago, and the character that when I was a kid I kind of wrote off as a Superman knockoff. He looks like Superman, has similar powers, but now reading these great stories, it's really making me appreciate this mythos more and making me want to go out and read more. I kind of want to read this ongoing now.
Yeah, I'm kind of into it as well. This is an interesting take. I think I probably enjoyed it a little bit more than Shazam and the Monster Society of Evil, just because it's aimed more at the kind of reader I am now. So, yeah, probably not going to check some more of this out on DCU at some point.
Yeah, and one other thing that I want to mention before we move on is one of the ways that the book maintains its sort of classical feel that makes it feel a little bit like it could be in the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, something like that, is some of the language that people use, which actually made me laugh a few times. Like, zounds is one that Savannah uses a lot. It's like, zounds, how could this happen to me? And then you've got a lot of holy moly, of course, which is a classic for Captain Marvel.
Sadly, no parish forbid.
Oh, if only. If only we could have gotten a parish forbid. But nonetheless, good stuff here. And by the way, the Wiz radio thing, I guess, ties back into Wiz Comics, which is where we first met Captain Marvel back in the classic year of our youth, 1940. And with that being said, folks, go out, check this book out. It's on DCU, DC Universe streaming app. It's also available through Hoopla, which is how I read it. It's also available, you know, you can probably find it at Second and Charles, places like that. There's lots of ways to read this one, so please go out of your way to check this one out. It's a good story, and while you're at it, send Jerry Ordway a tweet or two and let him know how much he's appreciated, because he's one that does fly under the radar, and I'm guilty of it too, of not talking about this guy enough. So anyway, we're going to take a break. Of course, next week we will conclude Shazam month, as we're going to be joined by the manager, Todd Weber, if all goes well, with scheduling, to discuss the, speaking of the DC Universe app, the 1970s Shazam TV series, which has been remastered in high definition and put up on the DC Universe app. And Nick and I are going to be diving into this one for the very first time. So look forward to that one. Of course, if you have any feedback about this episode, The Power of Shazam, any questions about the book, any comments on the book, or any comments about Shazam in general, tweet us. I am at gphillips8652. Nick is at nickduke87. You can join the Place to Be Nation Comics Facebook page. Just type in Place to Be Nation Comics on your Facebook search bar. Pull it up. Join the group. Join the discussion. And also, you can shoot us emails, gregp@placetobenation.com, nickd@placetobenation.com. And what we're going to do now is take a break. When we come back, we are going to tell you all about some of the hit shows you can find here at Place to Be Nation Pop and Place to Be Nation Wrestling. And we'll also have Watching and the Rundown.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have over 24 podcasts available on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. We now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed, we dive into topics running the gamut from today's WWE to the glory days of yesteryear and the ins and outs of the territory days. In addition to our full-length shows, we also deliver to you special pod blasts on topics old and new.
The Place to Be Nation Pop feed is a veritable treasure trove of great content. Offer tremendous shows covering the land of movies, television, life, comics, and sports, brought to you by the most knowledgeable and insightful folks in the podcast world.
You can find all these great shows, plus archives of our past podcasts from over the past 8 years as well, by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while you're there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows, plus others, available on PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth search projects, and much more. Be sure to support our site by using www.PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping. We want to thank our friends at Boneheads, Wing Bar, ProWrestlingOnly.com, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com as well. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Welcome back from the break, ladies and gentlemen. You are still listening, presumably, to the hard-traveling fanboys. And we are back to hit you up with, gosh, we got a couple of segments coming your way where we'll tell you what we've been reading and watching. Mm-hmm. We'll give you a rundown of the news and notes in the comic book world. But first, we want to let you know about all of the great content you can find here at Place to Be Nation Wrestling and Place to Be Nation Pop, Nick.
Absolutely. So stop me if you've heard this before, ladies and gentlemen, but we had a busy week on the Pop feed with a little something for everyone. And again, stop me if you've heard any of this before. Steve and Kelly are joined by Jason Sherman on the newest Songs with Friends, and of course, they talk about Bush. Greg and Nick are here. That's us. Well, the new Longbook Hunters. No, we're not. This is late. We're actually the most recent one you're listening to is this one, and we just talked about a book that you've already heard us talk about. Oh, Andrew and Adam are breaking down where the non-NBA playoff teams are headed in the newest NBA team podcast. The Marvel Age crew is here and moving into 1970. There may be a new one by the time that you hear this podcast. We don't know yet. Jenny and Tim welcomed Glenn and Butler, but all this is already outdated because the new Talkin' Pop has JT Rosero talking the WrestleMania 35 weekend. So look at me just adjusting the live read on the fly. Look at me just leaning into it, Greg. This is awesome. And, of course, Geek and Sassy couldn't let award season come to an end without the second annual Sassies. So check out what Jenny and Miranda fans had to say as they officially put a bow on 2018. And, of course, we can't forget, Greg, that a new contest is being held over on Looking Forward, Looking Back. We will be doing a summer movie wager based on how well...
What was that?
based on how well you think you can predict how this summer's movie releases will do at the domestic box office. So what you need to do here is you got to pick the top 10 movies in order of how you think they're going to finish in domestic box office gross. You will also need to include 3 wild card picks, as well as which movie you think will be the biggest bomb of the summer. As always, the rules are quite simple, but actually quite complex. Send your picks to lflbpop@gmail.com by Monday, April 22nd. Any movie that is released on or after April 26th is eligible, with the tally ending on Labor Day, September 2nd. The winner of the contest gets to be on a future episode of Laugh in Theater and pick any comedy movie of their choosing. What a prize for the winner.
You know, if you were to mess with the tally in some way, that would make you a tallywhacker, would it not?
You're a tallywhacker. You've whacked the tally.
And once again, that show is looking forward, looking back. What the hell? Anyway, I've already submitted my list. I submitted it this week. Oh, I'm not confident in it.
Aren't you special?
Because I was not sure on the biggest bomb. I went back and forth between Men in Black International.
Now, let me tell you something. Let me tell you where you're and wait a minute. Now, do they ever define bomb?
Yes. It's going to be the largest percentage difference in budget versus box office
gross. Now, let me tell you where you're going to make your fatal mistake in this contest, and I say this as someone who's probably not going to submit a list for it. You, given your irrational hatred of the live-action Disney projects, are not going to think of The Lion King when it comes to your top, like, 2 or 3.
Completely false. Completely false. I have it as my number 3, behind only Avengers Endgame and Toy Story 4.
I think Lion King makes more than Toy Story 4.
Really?
Yes.
Explain.
I think that the live action hook, the all-star cast, I think it will be an easier sell to people who don't even have kids than Toy Story 4 will be. They'll both be massive, don't get me wrong, but I'd go Lion King at number 2.
Interesting. I do think Lion King will do substantially better than Aladdin.
Yes, right. Aladdin doesn't really have any buzz about it, and it comes out in like a month, so...
Well, let's move over to the PTB and wrestling feed, shall we, Nick?
Let's do
talk
that.
About some of the great things we can have going over there. Over at the PTB and wrestling feed, Nate Milton, the Godfather, and his crew are here to break down WrestleMania 35 on a very special edition of Chain Reaction. Not the Keanu Reeves movie, but the show. Chris and Devin are here.
Say it.
With the PTB and... Chris and Devon are here with the PTBN WrestleMania 35 reaction show. JT and Chad returned with a new Wrestling War Zone as they finish off 1995 with a discussion about Starrcade. And we continue our dip into the Where the Big Boys Play vault as Chad and Parv start to look at Starrcade 87. Not a complete look, but a start of a look. And meanwhile, back at the ranch, old Nick and Greg, Nick and old Greg, deliver What If number 2 as we examine a world where CM Punk doesn't leave the WWE in 2014. And be sure to check out PlaceToBeNation.com as things are getting back up and running there with plenty of projects and reviews to come. Content will be picking back up in the days and weeks ahead.
Man, what a series of momentous announcements here on our live read.
A lot of new information there, Nick.
Mm-hmm.
Information that is good. A lot of good shows out there on the feeds right now, both feeds, in fact. And so, anyhow, let us move on to our weekly segment where we tell you what we've been reading and watching. And really, we just tell you what we've been watching because we haven't been reading anything, and except for, you know, long book hunts. So on the viewing front, Nick, I think all we had this past week, because I didn't watch Walking Dead or Doom Patrol anymore yet, but all we had this past week was Legends of Tomorrow, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And let me drop a spoiler on this for you. I didn't actually watch Legends of Tomorrow because I forgot. So. I was so busy watching the golf and the baseball over the weekend that I didn't forget think to watch Legends of Tomorrow. So tell me about Legends of Tomorrow.
Let the record show, ladies and gentlemen, the man that always mocks me for being ill prepared did not watch a beloved comic book show mm-hmm. of his in favor of baseball and golf.
Yep, I did. That's an accurate statement. That's an accurate statement. I'm sorry I was following one of the biggest sports stories in our lifetime, Greg.
And baseball.
And baseball, yeah. I can't defend that one. You know, we'll move past that.
But nonetheless, well, Legends, I thought, was a little bit of a step back from what we saw the week before with that great Lucha Libre episode. This one brought the gang back to 1973, and I don't want to say too much because I don't want to spoil it for Nick, but I thought it was a good, not a great episode.
How was Nixon? Episode, how was Nixon? That's what I'm going to – that's where this Nixon. Episode will live or die for me.
So I'm of two minds about Nixon because being real, Nixon was terrible.
Yes.
But
yes,
but
I love it.
That's sort of what we were looking for.
Yes.
It was a guy that didn't even look like any version of Richard Nixon there's ever been. Mm. Like he didn't look anything close to him.
Did he sound like the Watchmen guy?
Not quite like the. No one quite has ever matched the Watchmen guy. But he did go for those broad strokes, sort of like impersonating an impersonator of an impersonator of Nixon. You know, mm-hmm. where it's so far removed from the actual person that it's you're doing a caricature. But yes, he did go for that, and it did provide some good humor because they went with the "I am not a crook" and things of that nature and. Him just talking like this all the time.
Yes. Yes.
So yeah, that was good. That was good. In fact, I could argue he wasn't in it enough. But all that being said, solid episode of Legends.
I have a thought for you in the wrestling minute whenever we get there. Anyway, continue. Sorry.
Does it have to do with life not being fair?
No, it has to do with what WWE thinks all of Bayley's tag team partners should look like.
So this week, folks, there will be no wrestling minute. Richard Nixon does not get a chance, unfortunately, to deliver a "That can't be me!" You know. Anyway, but yeah, so solid, unspectacular, mm-hmm. and that's all I got for y'all on the on watching this week. Because I don't want to say any more. I don't want to spoil. Anything for Mr. Duke.
Now, I have been doing some reading, Greg, but the listeners will have to tune in to the newest edition of the Marvel Age podcast to hear about that, as we should have a new episode covering the back half of 1970 dropping pretty soon.
Do you find yourself admiring 1970's back half?
Depends on the back half.
Anyway, let's move on to our weekly look at the news and notes in the world of comics. It is a little segment known the world over, all the way as far as New Zealand.
New Zealand, yeah. Or Egypt. Or Suriname, as we found out earlier this week.
That's right. As the Rundown. Well, lots of news to get to this week. Well, not really a lot of news, actually. Comparatively, not very much news. Mm-hmm. But some big news to get to nonetheless. Mm-hmm. And I think, first of all, I know your favorite fictional character is Bruce Wayne, a.k.a. Batman. Mm-hmm. And we got news related to your favorite fictional character just this week. So Game of Thrones actor Ian Glenn mm-hmm. will portray Bruce Wayne in season 2 of DC Universe's Titans.
For those of you who are Game of Thrones fans, this is the guy who plays Sir Jorah Mormont, a longtime close associate of Daenerys Targaryen on that show. So he's been a fixture of the show since the day one, and now he's got a new high-profile gig to jump onto with Game of Thrones wrapping up.
So I don't know much about this actor. I think I've seen his face around. Certainly, mm-hmm. I've seen him in different projects before. I've not. Really
and even though you haven't watched Game of Thrones, you've probably seen him in like promotional stills or like attached to articles at some point.
So this is going to be the older Bruce Wayne who is trying to reconnect, as we find out in this article. He understands the need to rebuild his relationship with Dick Grayson. You might even say he has to redesign, rebuild, and reclaim.
Indeed.
And what do you make of this casting, Nick?
It's interesting on a couple of levels, because even for an aging Bruce Wayne, I think this guy looks a little older. I think in real life he's either 57 or 59, I can't remember, but he looks a little bit more haggard. Perhaps it's because I'm used to seeing him on Game of Thrones than I would often think for someone to look like Bruce Wayne. He's also a little bit more narrow in terms of build. Like he's kind of taller and skinnier than I usually associate Bruce Wayne with being. But he's a good actor. It'll be interesting to see him do an American accent for the project. So I'm intrigued. You know, at the very least, they got a good actor, which is what they'll need to really sell us on whatever's going to happen with this character and how he's going to fit into this Titans universe.
He's kind of wide in the shoulder and narrow at the hip. But everybody knows you don't give no lip to Big Wayne.
To Big Bruce, yep.
Yep. So, I'm excited about this. We both thought after season one that they have to include Batman on this series. They just have to. The way the story was going, you can't just hint around and tease that much without delivering. And, you know, we say even though Arrow teases us with Green Lantern every couple of years. But nonetheless, I want to see this relationship built upon. I want to see them not at odds with each other the way that we've seen in season one. I want to see them rebuild that relationship. So interesting stuff. I don't know. Like I said, I don't know much about the actor, but you tell me he's good. And so I will take your word for it and look forward to seeing where it all goes. Now, moving on from Bruce Wayne and DC Comics, let's move over to Marvel's overlords at Disney. They released some more information about the Disney Plus streaming service, really confirmations more than new information. And what we got this week is the confirmation about the live action streaming series set in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. So Kevin Feige announced that Tom Hiddleston, Anthony Mackie, Sebastian Stan, Elizabeth Olsen, and Paul Bettany, will all return to their big screen roles in the long-form series, plural, Loki, Falcon and Winter Soldier, and WandaVision.
Mm-hmm.
He also revealed that the first episode of the original animated series based on Marvel's What If, will be what if Peggy Carter got the powers from the super soldier serum and Steve Rogers remained his scrawny self, but was given a super powered suit of armor designed by Howard Stein. That can't be the title, but
no,
was given a super powered suit of armor designed by Howard Stark. So basically Steve becomes Iron Man. Peggy becomes Captain America.
Yes. And kind of a retro version of Iron Man, probably, you know, that's going to have a distinct visual look to it. I'm into this, but you know, I'm into the entire concept. And
I'm into Peggy Carter in general. I want to see more of Peggy Carter. Her show got cut. Of all of the Marvel shows, hers was the one that got done dirty more than any other. And I wanted to see more of that show before they canceled it. Yes. So looking forward to Peggy returning. Good lineup here, Nick.
Yeah, I'm excited. I mean, they also revealed, I believe, the price. I know it's going to be $6.99 a month, or I believe you'll have a $60 or maybe it's $75 a year option. So you'll save a little bit of cash on the annual subscription. But with all the content they're going to provide us between this original Marvel content, original Star Wars content that's coming, original Disney content, and the massive back catalog of stuff they're going to have access to between both the Disney and Fox libraries – this becomes a, as we've said before, a must-have on day one for me.
Well, that's certainly very good news. And yet, despite all of that, Nick, I feel pretty bad right now. And let me tell you why.
Mm-hmm.
The showrunners of FX's Why the Last Man adaptation, which is titled just Why, have announced their exit from the series over disagreements with the network.
Mm-hmm.
This is very upsetting to me, Nick, because Why is one of my favorite comic book stories of all time. I own every trade paperback of this series and love it. And I've been very much excited to see this turned into an FX series, but it looks like there's already creative differences. And I am in the boat of our friend Steve Willey, who indicated that if they're not going to do this right, he would rather it just not happen at all. Mm-hmm. And I'm kind of in that boat as well. I don't want to see a half-assed Why the Last Man. I want to see it done properly.
I do too. The creators have intimated, based on their Twitter statement, that part of the reason was that FX was pushing back against some of the political stuff that was going to be contained in the show. And you and I expressed concern a few months ago whenever they said that, you know, they were definitely looking to ramp up the political commentary in the show to have it reflect the modern times we live in. And I said all along, the comic itself makes that statement for you. If you just do the comic, you don't need to add any more of that. You don't need to make it any more obvious.
There, but that's not the story.
And so if that's really the reason they left, I think I'm on the side of the network here. You don't need it.
You know, that. I didn't know that. I didn't know that information until you just said it, Nick, because I admittedly have not researched this topic thoroughly.
Right.
But if that's the case, I'm with you, because I didn't want this to turn into some like cliched, you know, this is our feeling on political issues of the day show, because that's not – yes, the book has that, but it does it in such a subversive, subtextual way that is much more interesting and impactful than doing what everybody else does. And so maybe I'm with you on that. You got to stay – you got to maintain adherence to the story, in my opinion, and that's key in this situation. So we'll have to see how it plays out and where it all goes. But we also got news that will affect you and not me, Nick, this week. Because Nintendo of America has unveiled the cover art and release date for the Switch exclusive Marvel Ultimate Alliance 3, The Black Order. This is the first game in this series since 2009's Ultimate Alliance 2 and will arrive exclusively on the Nintendo Switch on July 19th. Now, this is, of course, being developed by a different studio than the one that developed the first two games.
Yes, Activision did the first. I believe Bandai Namco has gotten development on this.
So that remains to be seen how that'll turn out.
I mean – you know, the first two weren't exactly technically complicated. Like, they were pretty straightforward games.
Right.
I mean, hopefully they would get the message of don't – you know, people are excited because they just want more Ultimate Alliance. They don't want a re-envisioning of the series. They don't want a reimagining of the series. Like, just give us what we want. So we'll see if that happens or not.
What would Batista say about this game?
He would say, give me what I want. And he would say it over and over again.
There you have it. This is really exciting, though, in all seriousness. I love the Ultimate Alliance games. We've been clear about that on the show before. They're so much fun to play with people, to play with friends, to get your buddies over in a room and play together. And maybe I think there's a potential, since it's next gen, I don't know the dimensions of the Switch and the limitations of it and all that, but maybe you could even get more than four players at a time on a team. That would be cool if they kind of – expanded it like the arcade version of the X-Men game, if you remember, that you could play up to six people at a time.
What?
That would be really fun.
Well, and I know that, because I've done this before, Super Smash Bros. Ultimate supports up to eight players locally at any given point. So I don't know what the plan is for this, but I know that the Switch is certainly capable of going above the four-person mark. And I know you say it doesn't affect you, but I'm sure you'll get to test it out at some point during an event that we selectively invite people to because we're assholes.
Oh, well. So, c'est la vie. That's true. So, what's the only remaining story on our list? Why, of course, it is information about – let me see if I can get this title right, Nick. Birds of Prey and the Fantabulous Emancipation of One Harley Quinn.
Mm-hmm.
They have wrapped filming on this project before the inevitable reshoots occurring on Birds of Prey movie, which will come out in probably about 3 months. But for now, they have wrapped filming, and they have revealed the logo of Birds of Prey. And so this is all wrapped up, and You know, the Margot Robbie is there and as Harley Quinn, and it's good and all that. It's going to be a good movie. Well, hopefully, I shouldn't say that. I don't know if it's going to be a good movie, but hopefully it will be a good movie and pick up the strands where Suicide Squad failed us. I'm also looking forward to getting some footage, hopefully soon, from the movie.
Yeah, right, Nick? We're about 10 months away. I think it has a February release date of 2020. So we still got a little while to go, but I'm excited. I'm excited about this film. We've heard good things thus far. The little snippets we've seen seem intriguing. So, yeah, all is on track. And like you said, there will undoubtedly be reshoots, but I think that's just – that's the name of the superhero game these days.
And with that being said, that brings us to the end of the rundown. And why waste any time, Nick? Why not just move right into one of the most popular segments of our show in Bucksnort, Tennessee, for our listeners there?
Mm-hmm.
It's a segment called The Wrestling Minute. Well, the big news this week in the world of wrestling was the Superstar Shakeup, which is actually still going on as we record this podcast on a Tuesday night.
Mm-hmm.
SmackDown is happening right now. And I thought on Raw we had, as a result of my rule of stuff happening equaling good Raws, I thought we had a good Raw with a lot of stuff happening. Granted, not all of it good stuff. But stuff.
Yeah, I mean, like, these Superstar Shakeup episodes, even if they aren't the best in terms of match quality, they're always intriguing because at least there's that little bit of added suspense of what the roster moves are going to be. So I'm with you. I enjoyed Raw, and SmackDown, as we said, is recording right now. And, of course, I'm looking forward to the new tag team of Bayley and Ember Moon, Greg.
Well, you've been sitting on that one for a while, haven't you?
I'm just saying.
Waiting on that.
It's not a joke. It's just a statement of fact.
Statement of fact. Yeah, I mean, I'm sure that'll be fine, you know? They're running out of partners for her on the roster, sadly.
Well, she hasn't tagged with Nia yet.
Not yet, but nonetheless.
Alicia Fox, they haven't tagged to my knowledge.
Well, I think Alicia's dealing with issues at the moment.
Bianca Belair, whichever she gets called up, could probably tag with Bayley.
Yep, she needs more seasoning, though. They need to leave her at NXT for now. She needs seasoning, and hopefully she'll get it down there. She's good. She's got a lot of potential. All that being said, I thought the matches were good on Raw with old Finn Balor and Andrade had a good match.
Mm-hmm.
Real good match. The 8-man tag was good, and we all got to learn a little bit about having a Viking experience.
We did indeed. We did indeed. So, yeah, mixed bag, but ultimately I give it a thumbs up, as you do.
The other big news happened just before we went on air today, actually a couple hours before, in that Luke Harper, who we actually saw in Dragon Gate USA many years ago as Big Rig Brody Lee, has requested his release from WWE right on the heels of a great match that he had with, I'm just going to call him Dijak, at the Worlds Collide event. Luke Harper has requested his release from WWE. Kind of a missed opportunity with this guy, Nick. Both of us thought he was a sure thing when he signed, and he's had certainly some shining moments with the Wyatt family over the years. But outside of a ladder match with Dolph Ziggler that was really good, he didn't really get a chance to shine as a solo act.
I agree, and it's a missed opportunity. I thought of all the guys we've seen in the indies, you know, a big guy like that who can move and talk, I thought there was no way he'd miss in WWE, and unfortunately he did. But maybe this is one of those situations where ultimately him moving on is best for both parties, and who knows, maybe he can come back one day as a higher priority.
And the great value for him on the indies cannot be overstated, because the indies lack true big men.
Mm-hmm.
You know, true, like, wrestling big men. They're tall, that tower over the opposition. And I think he's going to fill a very valuable role there if he does indeed get his release. Well, all that filibustering aside, that has been the Wrestling Minute. And gosh, Nick, I feel like we've covered all the grounds that we need to cover this week.
Well, except for, of course, the way we've been ending our show traditionally the last several months, with WWE Hall of Famer Jim Ross coming on and singing us a little music to take us out the door. And I don't, Greg, we need to talk to Jim about this. This segment has really just has caught fire. I mean, it is taken on a life of its own. And to this, and this week, we got a retweet from one of the most prestigious accounts that I can think of. That, of course, being the esteemed Torque Flicks. I know that's a favorite account of Place to Be Nation member Trent Williams is a big fan of Torque Flicks. We got lots of good things going on surrounding this segment. Jim Ross is bringing the sex appeal, clearly, to the hard-traveling fanboys. And I thought, Mr. Ross, no better way to address that than to embrace it head-on and talk about the sex appeal that you have through this week's song.
Well, first of all, I'd like to thank you for saying that, Nick. Now, I do appreciate it. It's true, of course, but I do appreciate it. You know, originally, when I was sent my papers for this week's episode, my preparation was all done to sing a different song, a song that was once sung by a man that I hired, a man that I fired a few times as well.
And you may get to, and you may get there. You're probably going to get there at some point in the very near future.
Absolutely. That's not even a question, quite frankly. But I like this song that you sent me here to sing, and so I'm gonna do this for you. I'm gonna sing this, and I'm going to dedicate this to some of the great talents that I've signed over the years. People like Victoria, people like Molly Holly, people like Trish Stratus, Hall of Famer, people like another WWE Hall of Famer, Lita, Amy Dumas, I don't know who else, other people, Tori Wilson. The other Tori that was with DX, her, you know, remember her, Ivory, people like that. So, ladies and gentlemen, without any further ado, I present to you this week's JR Sings the Hits. My milkshake brings all the boys to the yard, and they are like, it is better than yours. You're damn right it's better than yours. I could teach you, but I'd have to charge. I know you want it. The thing that makes me, now, what the guys go crazy for anyway, they lose their minds, folks. The way I whine, I think it's time. La, 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 la. Warm it up. La, 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 la. The boys are waiting. My milkshake brings every single one of the boys to the yard. And you know, That's why we don't need a union. The boys don't need a union. They're already in the yard. They're already cooperating with one another. If they just come into it with a mutual sense of understanding, there's no need to have a union. There's no need for health insurance, things of that nature. What they need to do is just come together in the yard and use the Undertaker as a model for their behavior. And they're like, it's better than yours. You're damn right it's better than yours. I can teach you, but I'd have to charge. Quite frankly, I can see you're on it. You want me to teach the techniques that freaks these boys. It can't be bought. Cowboy tried. He couldn't buy it. Just know, thieves get caught. Thieves like Eric Bischoff, who robbed our talent roster of its dignity. Watch if you're smart. La, 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 la. Warm it up. La, 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 la. The boys are waiting. My milkshake, it brings all the boys to the yard, and they're like, it's better than yours. You're damn right it's better than yours. I can teach you, but I'd have to charge, quite frankly. Once you get involved, everyone will look this way. So, you must maintain your charm. Same time, maintain your halo. Just get the perfect blend. Plus, what you have within, then next his eyes are squint. Then he's picked up your scent. La la. La, la, la. Warm it up. La, 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 la. The boys are waiting. My milkshake brings all the boys to the yard, and they're like, well, better than yours. Damn right it's better than yours. I can teach you. But, folks, it's as simple as this. I'd have to charge.
Hard-traveling fanboys. Hard-traveling fanboys. Hard-traveling fanboys. Hard-traveling fanboys.